Shall we begin? Hello and welcome to the 13th Sir Roland Penrose Memorial Lecture here at Tate Modern. My name is Sandra Sikorova. I'm the curator of public programs here, and it's my great pleasure to introduce this evening's event titled Yes, We're Mad, No, We're Not Joking, a performative lecture by the British artist Michael Landy. This event has been developed in partnership with the Elephant Trust, and I would like to take this opportunity to thank them for their support, especially Ruth Rattenbury, who's been essential in making this happen, so thank you. And this evening, one of the trustees, Professor Dawn Addies, will be saying a few words about the Elephant Trust and also introduce Michael. Dawn Addies is a professor of art history and theory at the University of Essex, a fellow of the British Academy, and a former trustee of Tate. Dawn has curated some of the most important exhibitions internationally over the past 30 years, including Dada and Surrealism Reviewed, Art in Latin America, and Francis Bacon. Most recently, she organized a highly successful exhibition to celebrate the Salvador Dali centenary at Palazzo Grassi in Venice in 2004, and an exhibition titled The Color of My Dreams, The Surrealist Revolution in Art at the Vancouver Art Gallery in 2011. She was the associate curator at Manifesta 9 in 2012 and is currently working on an exhibition on the German Dada artist Hannah Hoch. Just briefly, before Dawn comes to introduce Michael, I wanted to talk about the format of the event. It's a kind of mix of performative lecture. There'll be also a Q&A and a raffle towards the end, which is very exciting. And I hope you all have a raffle ticket and you'll have an opportunity to win Michael Landy's artwork from the Saints Alive show. That's currently on at the National Gallery until the end of the week. And at around 10 past 8, we'd like you to join us for a drink in the adjacent staff foyer. So please join me in welcoming Dawn Addies. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Sandra. And it's a huge pleasure for the Elephant Trust to be sponsoring this lecture by Michael Landy. And before I introduce him, though, I want to say a few words about the Elephant Trust. It was founded by Roland Penrose and his wife, Lee Miller, a great photographer, in 1975. Now, Roland was an artist. He was a writer. He was a collector. And he founded the ICA. Now, among his collection was one of Max Ernst's most important early Dada paintings, The Elephant of the Celebes. And I'm sure you're all familiar with it, as it is now in Tate Modern. And it was as a result of selling that painting to Tate that Roland was able to set up the trust to support young artists and art that wouldn't otherwise get any support from anyone. So that's why we're called the Elephant Trust, named after the painting. And the main criteria, I suppose, of the Elephant Trust, what we try and remember whenever we're looking through the applications, and I encourage all to apply, is to bear in mind at all times an original, inquisitive, open-minded, generous, and unshockable approach to art in all its forms, with a bias towards the visual arts. This was more or less the injunction laid down by the original trustees, and we feel it embodies the spirit of its founders and remains the cornerstone of the Trust's policy today. Now, just a few words to introduce Michael Landy, who was born in 1963 in London, where he continues to live and work. He studied at Goldsmiths, and while there, he exhibited in the Frieze exhibition organised by Damien Hirst, the now historic show which launched the YBA group. Landy was elected as a Royal Academician in May 2008. Throughout his practice, the artist has created epic installations and performances to explore political and social issues. His 2001 monumental commission for Art Angel, Breakdown, was a systematic destruction of his 7,227 possessions in a former department store on Oxford Street in London. In 2004, he created Semi-Detached, a full-scale model of the front and back facades of his parents' house, shown at Tate Britain. Landy is also known for his meticulous, detailed drawings, having created a vast series of 80 intimate portraits of his family and friends, as well as his well-known series of carefully rendered botanical drawings of weeds. Most recently, Landy was the artist in residence at the National Gallery, and his show there, Saints Alive, is still on until the 24th of November. So, Michael Landy.
If you hold the back. I won't be able to do that in a couple of years' time. I've been practicing all week. Hello, everyone. I guess you've all got... where's the artwork gone? You've all got a raffle ticket. And sorry, where's the artwork? I thought maybe it was stolen. Oh, right, there it is. Okay. So at the end of the event, one of you lucky people are going to win an artwork by me. And it's one of my Saints Alive series. And it's called, I think, St. Jerome Contemplating a Crucifix. So if you stay at, thank you, if you stay till the end, which is an incentive, anyone walks out beforehand, you're out. But if you stay until the end, then you might win this. So this is Take Heart, and it's my first brush with the art world.
It's time to see some of your own drawings and paintings in the gallery.
It's a scraper board, and based on, I used to like daydreaming and look at patterns on wallpaper. That's me when I was younger. That's not actually part of the talk. So we'll move on to market. So this is at building one, former Nabrisco factory at building one. Yeah, so it's a former biscuit factory, and in 1990, this is what it is. So it's called Market because it's like a totality. And I liked I've been working on this piece for about a year. There have been a couple of other exhibitions called Gambler and Modern Medicine, which were organized by Carl Friedman and Damien Hirst and Billy Selman. And this is the third and final exhibition in this space. And it's basically, you know, it's like a real scale market. And I liked the idea that, because it's kind of full of stuff, but at the same time, I kind of feel it's completely empty. So, because there's obviously nothing, there's no produce on the actual store. So I liked, at this point of time, I liked the idea of the everyday, really. And that's kind of something that crops up quite a lot in my work, the everyday. And I liked the idea that the actual stores and, you know, could also morph into work pieces, and the crates could also morph into a stack piece or a collect piece, which are kind of individual artworks from market. And so I liked it being fluid, and the idea that, you know, it's like one of those kind of markets that kind of just come out of nowhere, and then, you know, it can all be taken apart and put back together again, and then it kind of disappears at the end of the day. So it's kind of like harping on the idea that, you know, that the idea that that real things exchange between real people. And I like the idea of exchange, which is so quite a lot of these kind of themes about the everyday crop up in my work quite early on with market. So I'm I had some appropriation videos as well, which kind of mimicked what was going on in outside. So it's kind of people putting out market stalls in earlier on in the morning. And it's like, I liked the idea that obviously it partly kind of mimicked minimalism in a sense, that a crate is designed to stack, so you kind of stack them on top of each other. And the crates themselves are completely kind of multi-useful. You know, art students use them as to make furniture out of them, and people, you know, people appropriate them. And so it says, like, the sole property of Allied bakeries who will prosecute for the retention or unauthorized use of this crate. And they literally have people driving around in vans prosecuting people for turning them into kind of ad hoc dining tables. So when I actually made this piece, the Allied bakeries were very sensitive about people appropriating their crates, because each one apparently costs £8, or maybe £4 back then. And so basically I had to sign a caveat to tell them that the actual crates would never go back to their former use, and that's of bread trays, basically their bread trays. They would always remain artworks. So that's kind of what I had to sign. So this is what I really liked about this piece was basically it was like a scale of a real life market, and people would wander around, and it everywhere would look the same as anywhere else. So there wasn't, apart from the three videos, there wasn't anything that really kind of stood out. So it was like, so you could be in any part of the space, and I like, as will kind of occur in later works, to treat everything the same. So I think this is kind of like a precursor to that, really. And this is a market stall, but then you could take all the elements apart and put it up against the wall, and it would become a work piece. So I liked that idea that, you know, it was a kind of fluid thing, really, that all these things could also be recycled into other different elements. That's an appropriation piece. We hand washed all the and waxed them all before the exhibition started. And so I was kind of very much into the idea of what the world looks like, and kind of copying that in some respects. And that's a work piece, and that's a stack piece. And this is one of just a short. This is Mr. Cruzon. I think he's still in Camberwell Green, and he looks a bit like Joseph Boyes. And it's just literally kind of setting out his stall for the day.
Just switch the lights on, please, in the front.
This is Closing Down Sale. I made this in 1992. By this time. I had a gallery called Carson Schubert Limited, and it actually used to be, the Carson Schubert Limited was literally underneath the actual Closing Down Sale sign. And so so obviously people who, from the city, would kind of walk past, people who worked in offices and stuff around here would like walk past, and they'd always make comments about what was in the shop window and on the contemporary art. And suddenly they obviously noticed that, you know, so this bawdy kind of Closing Down Sale sign and recession smash. And suddenly people said, oh, what a shame that the actual art gallery is actually shut down. And but this is kind of my immediate response to recession, because I'd never experienced a recession. I mean, I just literally got out of art school. And when I kind of entered the art world, it was still kind of very opulent in a sense. And then by 1992, the whole situation had changed. But also London kind of looked like this in a sense. Half of London felt like it was closing down. And this was kind of my response. And it was, I collected all this garbage and filled it with, I kind of customized all these shopping trolleys that I stole. And so it's all kind of defunct thing, washing machines, teddy bears that piss-stained, mattresses. I mean, it's all stuff I just kind of gleaned from skips and then put all these signs on. And so it kind of completely customized the space. And so people would still have their shopping heads on, and then people would literally like wander in and start looking through the shopping trolleys trying to find a bargain, but there never was any. So I'm going to try. At this point, I'm going to do a bit of a sales talk patter, which is here. So this is I've been trying to learn this since 1992, unsuccessfully. But where's my glasses? So I had this kind of audio tape playing around at the time where people were like wandering around. But I later found out the gallery staff used to switch it off when I left the building. But anyway, so this is partly of it. It's a step inside, ladies and gentlemen, have a look around, please. Everything must go. Everything's been reduced and everything's at a fraction of the normal shop and store prices. Don't believe me, I'm one of the world's greatest liars. But if you'd like to step inside, let your eyes be your guide, your pockets your judge, and the money the very last thing you part with. I said we'd treat you, and by golly, by George, treat you jolly well will. For today and today only, you're going to clear them out way. Yes, we're mad. No, we're not joking. Marvellous value for cash. Saving you cash. Saving you more money here today, ladies and gentlemen. It doesn't take a lot of working out. Don't walk by, because I was shy when I was a little girl here, and look at me now. Come inside, have a look around, please. Everything must go. Everything's been reduced. Everything's at a fraction of the normal shop and store prices. Whether you're 5, 15, 6, 16, or 66, I said we'd treat you and treat you with jolly well will. So today and today only, we're going to clear them out of the way. Yes, we're mad. No, we're not joking. Marvellous value for cash. Saving you cash. Saving you more money here today. Crazy, 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 crazy. Step inside and have a look around, please. Everyone's going to get a bargain here today. Bargains, bargains, bargains. They will not be repeated and they will never be seen again. So, I won't be able to do that in a couple of years' time either. But, so it literally festooned everything. So it like completely customized this space. So, I mean, so value is obviously another characteristic of mine and rubbish. In one form or another. I mean, these are kind of defunct things that people have just thrown aside. It wasn't, as I said, it wasn't a very successful sale because we never actually sold anything. So this is like basically like my kind of immediate reaction to like things were one price one moment and a lot less the next moment, and I was just trying to kind of grapple with that. This is Scrap Heap Services. And it's owned by the Tate for the last, I don't know, since 1995, I think it was. And this is basically, I'm just going to show one. Well, this is me, and it's like the beginnings of Scrap Heap. So it's because I wanted to make this fictitious cleaning company that got rid of people who no longer played a useful role in life. And this is basically the beginning of it. And this is an addition, actually. And by this time, I'd left my gallery, and I was like, I was out on my own. And obviously, so I had to kind of recreate this whole thing financially. So I was kind of having to deal with it financially and obviously having to create the piece as well. But I'm not going to say very much about that. And this is Michael Landy at home. And this is a piece of what I literally, as you say, it's 7 to 9 Fashion Street. And this is where I used to live. And by the time, I'd spent about 3 years in a basement making figures out of rubbish. And so by the time I came back up again, I'd sold this piece to the Tate. And I started to think about, suddenly I had things for the first time for a long time. I had a car and a suit and all sorts of things. And then I kind of thought, I was staring at the kitchen table one day, because I used to stare at bits of A4 paper, and thought, what's this all about and how can I mess it up for myself? And then I thought about destroying all my worldly belongings. So this is the beginnings of things, because normally I draw. That's kind of, drawings are, I draw first of all and I kind of draw out ideas. And this is all various ways that one could set about destroying your worldly belongings. So this is kind of the beginning. This is basically trying to open up a door to see if anyone's interested in the idea. And that's basically the purposes of this exhibition. I also, by this time, I'd have got my own milk crates, which later on, well, I destroy about, well, I had about 2,000 or 3,000 of them. And I think the first time I had them made, they forgot the D in unauthorized. And I'd had them, like, brought them up 5 flights of stairs and suddenly realized they'd forgotten it and I had to go back down again shredded and I had to get a whole new lot back up there. But basically, I created walls out of these crates. But also, we'll go on to that later on. This is broken, so I didn't realize it jumped. But how did we get here? But so this is basically about 3 or 4 years later after Michael Landy at home, because James Lingwood, one of the directors, came to see the exhibition, and they became interested in it's called Michael Landy's Lifestyle. But this is basically the this is a material. It was based on a material reclamation facility, and the idea of it is with recycling, it's all about identifying, separating things, and taking things of worth out of the waste stream. And obviously, what I'm doing here is kind of quite the reverse. I'm kind of taking everything literally apart, and that's kind of how I talked about it at the time, was that as a kind of examination of consumerism. And it would take one object about 10 minutes to travel around the whole space. And this is a former, it's Primark now, but it was the C&A building on Old Oxford Street, and it had been there for years, and we were just lucky enough to find the space, because they were basically moving out of Britain, and we were basically lucky enough to actually secure this space. I mean, I don't think we'd be allowed to do anything like that. I think the health and safety would shut it down. I was always expecting the health and safety to come along and actually shut it down, which obviously they never did. But it's based on a material reclamation facility, and I literally, like, we made an inventory of everything I owned, and we basically split everything down into, there was artwork, because obviously once you decide to destroy all your worldly belongings, it's all made up, but at the beginning it was just like consumer items. And then I thought about it a bit longer, and suddenly I thought, well, I'd have to have other things as well. Like, and in the end, I thought I'd have to have everything, basically. So we set about making an inventory of everything I owned, and which went into artwork, and then we had E for electrical, L for leisure, R for reading, S for studio, and MV for motor vehicle. And so we spent the first year just kind of creating this inventory of everything I owned, because obviously I did this at the age of 37. So I mean, obviously, when I was a kind of like innocent in a sense. So you're kind of consuming stuff, not knowing that one day you're going to destroy your worldly belongings. So you know, you end up with all sorts of odd things. But so it's basically like trying to create this inventory, and obviously you become aware at the same time you're also trying to create your biography as well, in a sense, all through consumerist items. And at the same time, I also realised that also I would become a spokesperson for the two-week performance. So you're not just destroying all your worldly belongings, but you're obviously having to talk to lots of people about why you're doing it, because people want to know why you're doing it, because obviously it's Oxford Street, it's a kind of mecca of shopping, and you know, people are kind of wandering down the street buying DVDs, popping into Dixon's, go to Selfridges, and then suddenly, you know, they're kind of coming up against this chap who's destroying all his worldly belongings. And it's not an art gallery. It formally, about 2 weeks before that, it'd been a place where people would shop. So I spent quite a lot of time trying to explain the motivations behind my actions. I talked about all sorts of consumerist ideas about it being the number one ideology of our time, and kind of what motivates us about consumerism. And obviously at the same time I realized that it was, you know, there are obviously, I had all sorts of different kinds of, there were like things with like, you know, financial value, but then obviously there were more sentimental things, and I had things like artworks, and so there were all sorts of different ranges of values that were kind of coming through. And people would literally, I think the best way it worked was that people would see the little kind of yellow trays traveling around, and they would like project their own kind of consuming habits on the actual trays. They would actually sort of question themselves whether they could do such a thing, and what would motivate someone like me to do that in the first place. So, you know, you could literally see, you know, things broken down. So you'd see some objects that were like, well, like, you know, a TV or whatever, and then you see other things that were just parts of the car. So I actually, with my car, I actually had it valeted, and I had it had a bump in it, and I knocked out the bump. So it looked like pristine just before we destroyed it, because I thought it'd be nice to have it looking its best before Dave Nutt, the sub Buddhist mechanic, took it all apart. Dave took at the end. He's, as I said, he's a sub Buddhist, and he took some of the granulated parts of the car and put it under a tree in India, sacred tree in India. So this is part. This is just some of the artwork to the inventory. There were like 7,227 items, and it went at the end of it all. It went to landfill. All 5.75 tons, apart from the bits we had stolen during the actual event, which most of the things were stolen were actually, because obviously things are stolen on Oxford Street every day of the year. And but most of the things were stolen at the private view, which says a lot about the art world. So this is part of the inventory. I'm sure there's big gaps. I've just jumped over that. I just can't quite remember now off the top of my head. But, I mean, it was basically, you know, suddenly, you know, you're having to... Because 50,000 people came to see it, so you're literally having to destroy all sorts of things that, you know, aren't necessarily state-of-the-art things in front of complete strangers, which was slightly embarrassing, and but I kind of got over that. And obviously, as time went by, because the kind of procedural guidelines we'd kind of written into it, it's all very kind of... automated in a sense, and everybody had their roles about taking everything apart and separating it, and then we had like different kind of material categories for, so it's all, you know, it's all kind of very mechanized. We had like you know, glass, plastic, you know, so everything was kind of, like I said, it was kind of like a recycling system, but obviously it was, I mean, they're all kind of, so I did, you know, I mean, part of Michael Land at Home was I looked at different ways one could, you know, I could give the things away, or I could destroy them, or I thought about lots of different ways one could go about doing this. And I talked about it at the time, was like, I was very happy with my life. I wasn't a madman. Obviously, a lot of people have things taken away by acts of God, floods and all sorts of things. And I mean, I was literally without something for about half an hour before someone gave me a Paul Weller CD, which was, I mean, I couldn't say no, because I felt that was kind of slightly churlish. So, I mean, I kind of realized that within no time at all, I'd start having stuff again. And it's kind of like breathing. It's, you can't avoid it in a sense, living in a Western society. You end up with stuff just coming through the letterbox or whatever. You just end up with it. And so I kind of, you know, my concentration was the actual 2 weeks, and I called it the happiest 2 weeks of my life, and it was. I felt very elated in a sense. Partly, obviously, my rationale of being an artist, that, you know, you get to this point, you spent years getting to the point where you can actually perversely destroy your worldly belongings in front of strangers, but I was also feeling very elated as well. So, you know, I started sitting on buses afterwards and start thinking about how to take them apart as well. So also, I should have mentioned at Take Heart, they actually destroy your artwork. The children's TV program at the beginning when I was, that's 1977. And they never sent the work back. They always destroyed it. So I always like to think that's the beginnings of everything anyway. So I didn't actually make any work for about a year after... after breakdown, because it just seems like such a finite thing. I didn't know how to move on. But I'd already become... Some of the books I destroyed were reference books about weeds, wildflowers. And I had an empathy for wildflowers. I mean, they used to grow in the estate around where I live, and they literally grow in cracks in the street. And so, you know, a weed doesn't... I used to try and grow them myself, but they always died. But a weed is basically a plant out of place, and that's the kind of terminology of it. And this is Shepherd's Purse, And you can't really tell, but they're little purses with seeds in them. But they appear sometimes in Bruegel paintings. And children play. It's also called Mother's Heart. Children pick them and make a child pick them, and the seed pod bursts open, and they say, "Oh, look, you've broken your mother's heart." So they have these kind of really nice stories behind them. But I really like them because they're really stoical things. Because, you know, you dig, they end up in bits of wasteland, they end up in all sorts of places that, you know, they're a kind of nuisance, but at the same time, they're very entrepreneurial. They don't need much soil or nutrients to actually survive. So I made a whole series of these, really, for about, this is an etching, sorry, and literally, like, so it's a lot, you've got, you know, I dig it up, and so it's a live plant, so you're kind of etching it, as you try to keep all the roots sustained in earth, and you know it's kind of dying as you're trying to etch it, and with an etching needle you can get very beautiful lines. So then I became much more kind of complicated kind of plants. But yeah, it's called a nourishment series, but which I made in 2002. That's my dad. And what happened was that they commissioned me to make. They asked me to tackle the Davin galleries at Tate Britain, and the Davin galleries are kind of classical space to show sculpture. And so all I had was this huge map of the Davin galleries, and then there's the octagon in the middle, and that's what I had. So they gave me a scale plans of it, and then. My dad had a serious mining accident. He's a miner, he's Irish. He met my mum over here back in the late 50s. And he had a serious mining accident at the age of 37 back in 1977, the 21st of July. And he remembers he was up in Northumberland, and he was borrowing, because he helped build bits of the tube line system as well, but he was up in Northumberland, and this cave collapsed on him, and so he was literally being buried alive, and lucky enough, you know, he could see the tree roots above his head, and lucky enough a chap came in and saved him, and but Dad ended up with all sorts of serious spinal injuries, and so he was in kind of a traction for about 6 months, and so we used to go up and visit him. But anyway, the reason I'm saying all of this is because when I used to come and visit him, it was the one thing that I kind of really felt really most passionate about, the plight of my dad, and trying to tackle that somehow, because obviously being an artist, you kind of want to tackle those kind of issues. So he was in like traction for about 6 months, and the reason I know all this is because I became artist in residence in my own family house, which was in Essex, 62 Kingswood Road, Ilford, Essex, IG38UD, and so I was literally, I sort of ensconced there, and I began drawing him at first, just because I didn't want to train a camera on him because I thought it was too intrusive. So I just started because I haven't really spent much time with him for quite a number of years. So I just kind of leached onto him in a way. So anyway, so basically my dad was no longer, because I remember the nurse saying at the time that my dad had big muscles on his neck because he was like literally cutting through the earth with a hydraulic spade. And so it's very primitive, but the only thing my dad ever wanted to do was be a tunnel miner. He didn't want to do anything else. So it's very similar to me, being an artist. Like I'd had, through Scrap Heap Services, they were trying to retrain me to do other things. And that's partly why I kind of created Scrap Heap Services to employ myself. So it became my own cottage industry to employ myself. And so Dad liked to do was burrowing through the earth. Like, it's a godforsaken thing. I don't know why anybody would want to do it, but that's all my dad wanted to do. So I got all these medical notes, and I remember reading that they basically wrote him off. Basically, terminology was that it's a complete wreck case. So it's like what one would talk about as a car, but they basically wrote him off. So he spent the next 35 years being looked after by my mother, So you can see, I mean, it's all kind of high-powered, kind of emotive stuff, in a sense. And I just wanted to articulate that somehow. So I began with drawing him, and that's his bypass. It's one of his bypass. So it really is, the NHS, it really is from cradle to grave. I mean, you can trace people's medical history literally through all these medical records. That's me, actually. I thought I'd just show you my penis. And then this is literally what I came up with. So this is, as I said, this is our Pebble Dash house. Well, I mean, it's a one-to-one replica of our Pebble Dash house in Ilford in Essex. What I didn't realise actually at the time was that by creating this house in the Davine Galleries, because it just about fitted, so it's just enough space either side for people to walk around, and that that people would actually want to go and see the original one. So my mum and dad got doorstepped by the Daily Telegraph, and they had like a picture of the original house, because obviously I thought, shit, of course they'd want to know to make sure I wasn't making it up that this house does exist. So people used to drive by or knock on the door. So for a while it became quite a place for people to hang out. And so so what happened really was, this is my dad's body, in a sense, that I thought my as because the only jobs my dad's left with are jobs around the house. And so and by this time he's even finding those hard to do. So as the house kind of deteriorates, my dad's physical condition also deteriorates, and so the whole thing starts to deteriorate. So the house, in a sense, does, the exterior of the house does become his body. So Mike Smith, who fabricated this, they did a great job. Apart from they couldn't do the ancient art of pebble dashing. I had to get some real pebble dashes in to actually do that. And so, you know, you have a whole kind of thing with the UPVC windows, this classical space and the pebble dashing, which I won't go. My mum provided the net curtains. And she also provided that little dolly that hides the toilet rolls on the first floor. And so so I basically split the intersection into two. So I put one half in the North Davines, one half in the South Davines, and I used the intersection as a kind of back screen videos. And I showed, this is four walls, and I think we were about to, it's my dad whistling. So it's rather rasping. So it's kind of like he's kind of whistling, he's kind of, this is Jim Reeves, welcome to my world. So it's one of the things that my dad used to like to whistle to. And this is all the DIY images he'd collected from the 1950s till till the 90s, really. So it's a kind of lament to work, really. Oh, it stops it. But anyway, so he had like thousands of images. So every time a note would happen, the image would change. So it's, you know, just people doing DIY around the house. So, And this is shelf life. This is just a Polaroid of the shelf. And this is kind of like my dad's own self-portrait. And it's basically, as I said, it was the only jobs he was able to do were kind of jobs around the house. And these are all the things, all his tools and all the things that made him really. There was a piece of fluff underneath that shelf that was like a hair and some dead skin or something. And when my mum switched on the central heating, it used to start to dance because of the air current. It was like a dervish. And I became obsessed with this piece of fluff. Anyway, I've got over it now. It's a video, isn't it? It's a motion control video. When it just starts straight away, I know it's very slow, but it's not normally that slow. Yeah, so it's a motion. So I tried to film this this shelf using a motion control video. That's a squash moth, which I didn't actually know, which literally was stuck on the wallpaper. And so it's kind of like another, I kind of saw it as another version of drawing, because I mean, I like detail and I like but then I like to expand the detail. Like I chose all the tools from Breakdown. I've always been very much, whether it's detail in someone's face or detail, you know, with a house, because I made a whole kind of photographic inventory of the house before we commenced fabricating the house. So I've always kind of seen kind of detail with things as well, but then and then trying to expand that onto a bigger scale, because the other thing about, obviously, a lot of the things I do, they're on quite large scale, but I think they're always a scale, a pertinent scale, really. So like a market is only, it's the scale of a market. And this is a drawing from Squash Moth. That's me as Zhang Tangli. And I saw a fantastic exhibition of Zhang Tangli's back in 1982 when I was a textile student at Loughborough. And I came down for the day, and I got some book tokens from Vision On, Take Heart, and I destroyed those during Breakdown. I forgot to mention that. I got some nice, Tony Hart used to present the program, so gave me some book tokens, but obviously I destroyed those. But anyway, and the reason I mention this is because also I came away with a metamatic drawing. John Tangley, sorry, is a Swiss kinetic artist, and he made very anarchic kind of sculptures that you'd put your foot on the welders and it would basically animate the sculpture or something, and it's all made out of junk, and sometimes it would work and sometimes it wouldn't. But I was just absolutely amazed, because it's the first time I'd ever seen people laugh or smile in an art gallery. And so it made a huge impression on me, and I think that's probably why I left the textile course and went to Goldsmiths after repeated attempts of getting in. But first of all, I tried to get into Goldsmiths' fine art course, but they didn't want me. So this is me. This is just a collage, and this is of a piece of work called Homage to New York, which I wasn't really aware of at the time. But the kind of associations, I like the idea that... This is just an extract of a film that DNA Pennybaker made. It's one of his first films, and this is Sean Tangley. He's got a monobrow, and he's talking in the Buckminster Fuller Dome. He's talking pidgin English anyway, so I have to talk over him. And I saw this book in Vancouver called Passage in Sculpture by Rosalind Krauss, and it had a black and white image of this piece of work. And suddenly, you know, I read a bit more about it. It was very similar to Breakdown, that, you know, Zhang Tangley, this piece of work only lasted for 27 minutes back in 1960, on the 17th of March 1960, and it was like 23 foot by 27 foot, and it was made out of junk. And it's called Homage to New York because it was the first time Zhang Tangley had ever visited New York, and it was his reaction to the city, basically. And he wanted to make something that was at complete odds with the skyscrapers and the whole kind of permanence thing. He wanted to somehow escape all of that and make something, in a sense, some respects he wasn't responsible for, that would have its own, he called it an intensive life, and this thing would actually destroy itself. And over 27 minutes. But actually, ironically, it's actually the New York Fire Brigade that destroyed it in the end. It didn't actually destroy itself. But I became very interested in recreating this work, which I failed on. But obviously, because it existed, then it had a copyright implication. So suddenly, I had to try to get copyright clearance, which I failed to do. But I'm still trying. I haven't given up yet. But I'm still alive. I'm still going. So here's kind of immediate response. He called it like Chinese fireworks. So it's like his immediate response. So like how sometimes sculpture can be very fixed. He wanted to kind of go beyond that, and he talked about it as being a kind of like life itself. He liked it being like it's kind of like ephemeral life, and that's a portrait of me, and I made it. I can't remember how I get from Homage to New York to drawing portraits of people, but that's kind of what I do. I guess, like I was saying earlier on, I mean, I like detail, and I was kind of spent like 2 days torturing people whilst I drew them. So, I mean, they were literally like, I didn't draw from photographs, I literally drew from people about this far away. So I started with drawing myself, And then I moved on to my whole family, and then I moved on to friends and acquaintances. So I think I made about 80 portraits altogether. I began, like you saw the scraper board at the beginning, I mean, I began being an artist through copying stuff out of books. And the school teacher said I was good at that, and how wrong they were. I think it was kind of my way into being an artist, really. But then, you know, for years I'd stopped drawing. I didn't draw at all whilst I was at Goldsmiths. And so I drew my whole family. So it's kind of embarrassing when you first sat down to people and you stare at them about this far away. And then people deal with it in all sorts of different situations. Some people want to talk to you. I tried to always be quite neutral. If people wanted to talk, I'd talk. If they didn't want to talk, I was quite happy not to talk. But it was, I remember like looking at my sisters, that's one of my sisters, and look, we hadn't really looked at, you don't really look at people. I mean, you know, you don't really look at people. And so suddenly you're looking at people, you know, right into their face. And obviously I'm in power because I've got the piece of paper and the pencil. And obviously, I mean, I've tried to bully some people if I could get away with it. It's just, and that's my other sister. This is all my family. I had to bribe the kids, obviously.
Signed version. So
and then I jump. I don't know how I get from one thing to another. I'm sure there are all sorts of, there are other works in between, but anyway. And this is Art Bin. And I was slightly intrigued by, at the time of breakdown, like all the hullabaloo over the destruction of artworks. And I guess this is the South London Gallery. This is back in 2010. And I'll get this all wrong. But in this country, as far as I remember, you can't change the colour or something, or you can't add to it, or, you know, you can't defame it, but you can destroy it, bizarrely enough. And obviously, destruction in art comes in lots of different guises. Like, one has the Zhong Tangli self-constructing, self-destroying sculpture that he made. It's like one of the first happenings of its time. And then, obviously, you have other examples of, like, Rauschenberg erasing the de Kooning. And that's a kind of like a collaboration, or Man Ray's object to be destroyed. But then obviously you have the Reformation, you have the suffragettes. You have lots of different ways to do it. But anyway, so I've always, as I said earlier on, I mean, I've always been interested in worth and value, and obviously, and also, I mean, I talked about this as being a kind of monument to creative failure. So, I mean, I asked artists, and principally artists, to destroy their artworks. I did ask collectors as well, but they'd have to obviously ask the artists, which I'd imagine would be quite difficult for them to do that. So everybody had to sign a form to say it was their artwork, or they'd had the permission. So I liked this. I liked the structure itself. They basically almost took up this whole space. And obviously a bin is one that's supposed to put rubbish into a bin. And the part of the reason I'm interested in rubbish is kind of our leftovers from societies, and it's the stuff we've become very good at getting rid of. We just, you know, we've created all these systems to get rid of it all because we find it so offensive, in a sense. You know, there's rubbish on the moon, there's rubbish on Mount Everest. You know, wherever humans are, there's going to be rubbish. I mean, it just kind of follows us around. So, but this is artwork. This is different. And I became interested in what I really liked about it, because after a while, one thing would start to morph into another thing, and you'd, you know, one artwork would pierce into another, or it would shatter onto it, and then suddenly you weren't so aware, because I was talked about it as once things were in the bin, in a sense, everything had the same value, in a sense. So, you know, because it was, they were never coming out of the bin. So, you know, you start to kind of aestheticize about it. So I like, some people would literally lock their doors, their studios, and they wouldn't, you know, you don't psychologically know what to deal with this stuff. So that, I obviously offered that service as well to get rid of all the whole practice. But, I was quite happy if people weren't to get rid of things they liked. It was entirely, entirely up to the artist, whatever they wanted to do. So it was quite odd, the opening, I remember. It was more like some kind of public kind of flogging or hanging, like with some very weird kind of atmosphere that I'm not sure if I want to be associated with. But so yeah, this is, I mean, it's a 600 meter cubic bin, so it's a big bin to fill. I did actually want it to go on tour, but we couldn't find anyone to take on tour. But I'm actually going to make this recreate this in Yokohama in Japan. So yeah, yeah. So you had like well-known artists, completely unknown artists, art students. We had the Camberwell School of Art next door. Some people put it on their CV as like part of a group exhibition, I guess. And some people like looking into the bin and see if they could spot anything famous. I did ask Damien Hirst to put some work in the bin, which he did. But all the young people just wanted to get out of the bins, and then you know, they could create a whole new life for themselves. But I said no. So as I say, like, things start to kind of mesh and mingle in together. And as you say, you kind of start to aestheticize it. How am I doing with time? 10 minutes, okay. 15, that's the cast of my face. Someone decided to throw that in the bin. And so this is, because when I destroyed all my worldly belongings, more or less immediately afterwards, like I was saying earlier on, I had to front up, talk to people about, you know, consumerism and like being the number one ideology of our time and how we construct our whole lives through it. But also what I became very aware of was how kind people are, because I thought, you know, people were common denominator, but I actually found people, surprisingly, quite open to the idea of breakdown. Anyway, so I came away thinking I'd like to do a project about acts of kindness, but obviously there aren't any acts of kindness in art galleries. So I had to find the right forum for that to occur. And a roundabout way it ended up on the London Underground. And I became interested in, one day I was just sat on the tube one day and someone, you know, very, you know, gave their seat up to somebody. And then I kind of started to kind of intellectual, why would one do that? And, you know, when one doesn't have to do that. And so then because I'm interested in part of what, you know, probably what you know, so I'm interested in the everyday. So I talked about it as like everyday acts of kindness. There's a George Frederick Watts he's an RA, but he also created a memorial for people who lay down their lives in the Postman's Park in the City of London. But I mean, my things were much more about the everyday kind of stories about, you know, you've got a bit of shaving foam on your ear and then someone points it out and you get rid of it. I mean, just very kind of very simple stories. So so I kind of wondered why we talk about us being less kind than we were maybe 30 or 40 or 50 years ago. I mean, some people believe that the advent of Thatcherism, because I left school in 1979 when Thatcher came to power, was the end of the beverage kind of kindly society, that we became much more individualistic. And obviously part of what Scrap Heap Services was about was the kind of, it kind of felt at the time the kind of mass unemployment in a sense from, things closing down. So anyway, so I kind of thought about, because the whole thing about kindness is that you have to involve yourself with other people's emotional needs, which is slightly precarious because it has an unknown outcome. So it's like kind of, you know, it's that kind of idea of connecting yourself with a complete stranger. And so it's like that kind of idea of self to other. And so I had to come up with a way of obviously visualizing this and getting the idea out to